You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Most everyone agrees that our healthcare system is broken. Some 50 million Americans lack adequate coverage. Insurance premiums have risen nearly 100% over the past 8 years, and medical bills are the leading cause of bankruptcy in the United States. Here to offer his prescription for healthcare reform is former Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle. He's written a new book, Critical: What We Can Do About the Healthcare Crisis. It's published by St. Martin's Press, and I'm delighted that it has brought Tom Daschle back to the show. He is currently a visiting professor at the Georgetown Public Policy Institute and distinguished senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Scott Greenberger and Jean Lambrew are also given credit on the cover. What roles did they play in the writing of this book?
Well, they're true health experts. I've enjoyed working with them in part because I've learned a lot in my research with them and the direction we wanted to take the book in public policy. Jean has worked in public policy for a long time. Scott has done quite a bit of the research, and so I felt that they deserved credit for all the work that they did.
Hasn't Congress been trying to pass health care reform legislation since the Truman administration? I think the last time was after Harris Wolfert made it a national issue when he won a Senate seat in Pennsylvania. And it looked like we might actually see a change, but that didn't happen. Do you think the country is finally ready for health care reform?
Well, there are really two questions. Have times changed enough since the last time we tried this 15 years ago? And do the forces of change actually exceed the forces of the status quo? In both cases, I think the answer is yes. Times have changed. As you noted as you introduced the book, things have gotten a lot worse, and they're getting worse by the year in terms of cost, in terms of quality, in terms of access. And I think that there are far greater forces for change than there are forces for the status quo.
But hasn't there been resistance? Maybe it was mostly during the Cold War, to what President Eisenhower called creeping socialism. How do you convince critics that this is not just another step towards socialized medicine?
Well, I think that's exactly what the opponents have always used. I think it's important first that we try to put the opposition on the defensive. Usually it's the opponents that put the proponents on the defensive, and I think we have to ask people today, are you satisfied with the status quo? Are you willing to accept another 100% increase in the next 10 years? Are you willing to accept the fact that we're 35th in overall outcomes and performance today in the world, even though we pay more than any other country in the world? And I think you start with that, but then you also have to convince people that we're not asking for a single-payer system. We're not suggesting that we go to a European-style health system. You can argue for that, but that isn't what America's going to have.
Well, there are people who will tell you that America has the best health care in the world and that people come here from all over the world for gold standard treatment.
Well, that's one of the great myths of our country. We live with that myth, and it couldn't be farther from truth. We have what I like to call islands of excellence, the Mayo Clinic, the Cleveland Clinic, Johns Hopkins, in a sea of mediocrity. And that sea of mediocrity has produced, as I say, a performance level that ranks about 35th in the world today. We're 31st in life expectancy. We're 29th in infant mortality. And so use whatever criteria one will. The fact is we don't have the best healthcare system in the world. We have more people, actually, that leave to go to other countries to get healthcare than we have people from other countries who come here for healthcare.
Are there countries that you think have gotten it right with regard to health care?
There are. There are a number of countries that do it right. The Netherlands do it right in terms of overall outcome. They rank number one.
Would it be adaptable to the United States?
Well, I think that there are certain things that are adaptable. As I said, we're always going to have an American system. The American system is really two things, really. It's two systems in one. We have a public system, which is made up of seven different federal programs, Medicare, Medicaid, the VA, and others. And then we have the private system. 55% use the private sector. 45% use the public sector in our country today. What we need to do is to integrate those two systems a lot more effectively than we do today, and other countries have done that.
Since nearly 45% use the public sector, why do we think that we only have a private medical system.
Another myth. I think there's we perpetrate these myths in our country, I think in part because that's just the American way. We like to think of American systems as the best. Well, just like automobiles, we're not the best when it comes to making cars anymore, and we're not the best with healthcare anymore. Now, we do have incredible technology. We do have some extraordinary clinics in the world, in the country, but we aren't the best system.
My guest is former Senator Tom Daschle, who has written a book called Critical, What We Can Do About the Healthcare Crisis. It's published by St. Martin's Press in the Thomas Dunn Books imprint. You propose the creation of a federal health board modeled after the Federal Reserve Board. Could you explain how your plan would work?
Well, the plan would work very similarly to the way it works in the banking system. We have a private banking system, but a great deal of public infrastructure within our banking industry today, and that mesh, that integration between public and private, has been by design really one of our secrets to success. But it needs a manager. It needs a board with the expertise, the autonomy, and the authority to make tough decisions. If you can just imagine Congress trying to decide what the interest rate should be on a monthly basis, you get some sense of what it is for all the other decisions that are made by the Fed. Same is true in healthcare. Congress is simply incapable institutionally of addressing the many challenges we face. We need an autonomous board to make those decisions.
Well, is the Fed really autonomous? We see political pressures at work with the Federal Reserve Board, and we've seen people who have favored one political party over another. I would imagine something like this would be a minefield unless you were able to come up with the right board members. And I'm not sure that that's even possible.
Well, I think that it's always going to be a question of what system of decision making can we incorporate that provides the best opportunity for objective answers to the questions that we're facing today. I don't agree in all cases with the Fed. I don't agree necessarily with all nominees to the Fed. But I do believe that that autonomy and the expertise and the ability to make the decisions is unquestioned.
Well, how would the board members be put on the board? Would they be elected or would they be appointed?
They would be appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate, just as the Federal Reserve board members are. But they wouldn't stand for re-election. Right now, Congress is being asked to make decisions on reimbursement of physicians, let's say. Reimbursement of physicians is one of the hottest political health issues Congress is facing right now, and it won't surprise anybody in your audience to know that it's been more than, I think, 2 years now that this decision has languished in Congress simply because Congress doesn't want to have to make that decision, yet they're going to have to. That's one of the responsibilities they're delegated with. But those political pressures, the cross pressures, the extraordinary complexity have complicated the decision-making to a point where you couldn't possibly make all the decisions within the congressional environment today, in part because of their complication, in part because of the political pressure, and in part because I think there are too many other aspects that fall outside the purview of the committee process today.
The House passed legislation to broaden coverage for mental health services a couple of days ago, but the Senate may not go along, and the president is likely to veto the House version. That's mental health coverage. Why has that been such a problem?
That's Exhibit A, and that's such a great question, and it makes my point. That's a bill that I actually introduced with Paul Wellstone 10 years ago. We've been working on it for 10 years. Pete Domenici on the Senate side. I think it ultimately will pass finally, but it's been a long, long time.
Well, it has Republican support, and yet it's still unlikely. Well, it'll go through some real problems before anything really is resolved.
Well, it has some Republican support, but as you correctly note, it looks like the president's going to veto the bill, and they won't have the votes necessary to override the veto, so it'll languish again, even though it has some strong bipartisan support.
Why do you think that your plan will work when other reforms like the one put forth by Hillary Clinton and Ira Magaziner during the Clinton administration didn't work?
Well, that's a very good question as well, and I would say there are several things we've learned from that experience. One, we've learned not to introduce a 1,300-page bill. It provides too many targets. I think it has to be streamlined. That's also one of the great advantages of having a federal health board. You don't have to get into all the weeds because the board's going to be making those decisions, and you can delegate that responsibility rather than fight over it before the bill even becomes law. And I think, secondly, we've got to involve the chairs. And third, we have to use the what we call the reconciliation process, sort of the streamlined legislative process that we have available to us in the Senate. We didn't do that the last time, and that was also a mistake.
Would the Federal Health Board be an advisory board, or would it have enforcement capabilities?
It would have enforcement capability largely over the public side, over that 45%, just as the Fed does. The Fed really doesn't regulate our private banking sector. It regulates the public side, and that public sector involvement provides them with the leverage they need to influence the entire banking system. The same would be true with the Federal Health Board. We would deal with the 45% covered, and that would very likely have the same effect in health that it's had on banking. It would affect the deportment and the overall character of the entire healthcare system.
Well, the Federal Reserve has a lot less to get involved with setting rates and things like that, but we're talking about an agency that would have to perform hundreds of tests for pharmaceuticals, medical devices, medical products, set all sorts of rules for the way things are paid, doctors are paid. This sounds to me like a huge bureaucracy.
Well, this is meant to replace a lot of the bureaucracy. We have too much bureaucracy today, but let me also hasten to add that we're not advocating the replacement of FDA. The Federal Drug Administration has that responsibility, the Consumer Product Safety Administration. There are agencies delegated with certain specific responsibilities for safety and soundness, and those would continue. We're not suggesting the Fed does all of that, just like the SEC has its role, the Securities and Exchange Commission in our larger financial system in the industry today.
Who would pay for all of this?
Well, that's the other issue here. This isn't going to work if we can't reduce the amount of cost. And there are three forms of cost of reimbursement. There are taxes, premiums, and out-of-pocket expenses. I think that we can reduce the overall cost. $7,500 is per capita is what we pay today for our health care, 40% more than the second most expensive country. There's no reason we can't bring those costs down.
My guest is Tom Daschle. And he's written a book called Critical, What We Can Do About the Healthcare Crisis, written with the help of Scott S. Greenberger and Gene M. Lambrew, and published by St. Martin's Press in its Thomas Dunn Books imprint. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Tom Daschle, former U.S. Senator and Senate Majority Leader from South Dakota. He has written a book with the help of Scott Greenberger and Gene Lambrew called Critical, What We Can Do About the Healthcare Crisis. It's published by Thomas Dunn Books. You are an advisor to Barack Obama. So is this really the plan that he is proposing?
It's not exactly the plan. He and his great staff have worked hard to propose a comprehensive health care reform package that I'm very enthusiastic about. There are many, many similarities, but this wasn't intended to be an Obama document or an Obama proposal. It was one that I put forth, and as I say, I think the overlap may be 80% or 90%, but it's not his, and his is not mine.
Hillary Clinton and Paul Krugman, especially in the New York Times, feel that health care should be mandated. Otherwise, it won't really be universal health care. What's your argument against that?
Well, I don't argue against it necessarily, but I also hasten to would hasten to argue that even though it is true that a mandate may get us close to universal coverage. It doesn't get us there. Medicare only has 96% participation. We have mandates in insurance and health insurance in Massachusetts with 89%. California has a mandate for auto insurance, and it only has a 60% participation rate. So mandates are no guarantee. So in this debate, I'd say that both Barack and Hillary are right in that Barack argues that if you can't afford to pay for it, it doesn't matter how many mandates you've got. Hillary argues, yes, but you've got to have some legal requirement. I think there are a lot of ways to get to coverage for all, and there isn't any debate about that, at least on the Democratic side. Everybody in the leadership circles of our party strongly support this notion of coverage for all.
Why not require health insurance the same way we require drivers to have car insurance?
Well, that is something that many have proposed, and we talk some about that in our book, actually. But as I say...
Well, that's why I brought it up, by the way, Tom.
Right. You don't really have the guarantee, you don't have the assurance, even with the mandate, that you're going to get there. As I said, California has a mandate that you buy auto insurance, and only 60% of those... under the law, are currently purchasing the insurance that they're supposed to purchase. So it's a serious problem. And what we have to do is to provide the incentives. We have to provide the assistance in some cases to those who don't have the capacity to buy the insurance. And that's where I think a lot of states and the federal government in the past has fallen down.
Has Senator John McCain proposed a medical plan?
Well, he has proposed ideas. Primarily, his proposal is to provide greater tax relief for those who purchase insurance. The problem with tax relief is that we're really cost shifting. As I said a moment ago, there are only three ways to pay for health care. And those three ways are taxes, premiums, and out-of-pocket expenses. He suggests we reduce the amount of tax to incent people to buy more insurance. That's just cost shifting. That isn't controlling the cost. It isn't improving the quality. It doesn't do a lot for the access. And that's something that I hope will be debated during the coming months.
What effect would this all have on the people who run the current system, the health insurance companies, the HMOs?
Well, we propose in the book a concept very similar to what we have in the Senate, which is the Federal Employee Health Benefits Plan. What that is just a cafeteria of a lot of different plans that each federal employee is given each year to make a choice. You shop, and first we pool the resources, which helps with leverage. We define really what the basic benefits package should be, and then we say, okay, companies, if you want to compete, we'd love to have your participation in this plan and offer your services to our millions of employees. That has worked so well that I think we can adapt that same concept nationally, where we say, okay, companies, we'd love to have your participation, but at the very least, you've got to have a minimum benefits package, and we're going to make them available to every American. Let them decide which insurance plan they want.
And you suggest the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program to fill in the gaps between Medicare, Medicaid, and employee health care programs?
Well, we would actually offer the Medicare plan to anybody who wanted to sign up for it. If you wanted to buy Medicare at age 24 as your plan, we'd let you do that.
Oh, that would be a major change.
Well, it would be, but see, we think that there ought to be the Medicare standard applied to all other companies and let the competition work for itself. Everybody wants competition. I can't think of more appropriate ways with which to acquire that competition than to make sure you've got a standard by which all other plans are judged.
My guest is former Senator Tom Daschle. His book, Critical, What We Can Do About the Healthcare Crisis, is published by Thomas Dunn Books, an imprint of St. Martin's Press. Well, right now, we don't have rigid federal standards. Each state has its variation, doesn't it?
That's right, and that's really one of the big problems we face, is that as we go from state to state, the people who move from area to area in the country with some frequency are always uncertain as to what their circumstances are. It's really why we need a federal plan, a plan that will assure, regardless of how often you get transferred, and people now get transferred 7 or 8 times in their career, how wherever you work, wherever you live, you're going to have the confidence in knowing that at least when it comes to your health care, you're covered. You don't have to worry about the portability problems that we have today.
Medicaid doesn't cover poor adults who are childless and don't have any disabilities.
Exactly. It's a problem, and that's why we think that, first of all, covering people adequately is really one of the bigger challenges. We have a lot of people who have insurance, but according to Commonwealth Fund, 37% of those people who have insurance, people like you and I, don't get the coverage they need, don't get the care they need because they have inadequate coverage and have to pay too high an expense out of pocket. And Medicaid beneficiaries are like that in many cases. They aren't eligible for the benefits because they don't meet the very strict criteria.
The crisis in Medicare is as a result of estimates that the over 65 population will more than double over the early 21st century, from 36 million in the year 2000 to 78 million in 2040. So what should we be doing to plan for the explosion in healthcare customers?
Well,
and should
we
require seniors to have long-term care?
Well, I think that it's very important that we cover long-term care, mental health care, dentistry, all of the other forms of care. Absolutely. I think that we have to put a lot more emphasis on wellness than we do today. You know, we pay for the most expensive care. We don't pay for the least expensive, high-quality care that that could be available to all of us. We've shown with dentistry and cancer screening and so many other forms of preventive care today how cost-conscious we can be and how cost-sensitive those different procedures and access to good health care can be, too. So there's little doubt that we could do a lot if we put far greater emphasis on prevention. The other sad thing is my grandchildren actually have a lower life expectancy statistically than I do, and the reason for that is obesity. The obesity pandemic in this country is causing life expectancy and infant mortality and other issues to be exacerbated even more than they are today. So we have to have a wellness program, and that has to be part of the focus of this new system today.
How would your plan deal with the healthcare lobby, which has blocked proposals for reductions in Medicare payment rates?
Well, I think it's important, again, to go back to the board, because the board, for the first time, we'd have an insulation from the constant pressures that the lobbyists bring to bear. The pharmaceutical industry spent over $1 billion in the last Congress. The insurance company spent, the insurance industry spent over $1 billion, $2 billion, and that's just insurance and pharmaceuticals. The billions of dollars spent by the AMA and doctors and hospitals and everybody else involved make it one of the single biggest sources of lobbying effort on the Hill that that we have within our economy today. I think that is probably as much of a compelling argument as I can think of about the need for a board with the political insulation to make the tough decisions that we're talking about here.
But when this legislation is proposed, won't we be seeing more of Harry and Louise?
Well, it is possible.
Or do you think they're near retirement?
It is possible that Harry and Louise could reappear, but I'd like to see that they're advocates rather than opponents this time. And I think it is important for us to try to put the pharmaceutical industry or anybody else who opposes meaningful reform on the defensive. Let them defend the status quo. Let them defend the dramatic increase in cost and the extraordinary embarrassment that we must face as a country as wealthy as we are, who comes in 35th in overall quality.
I have I use prescription eye drops, and my drops leaked when I was visiting France. I called my pharmacy here and asked him to send me some, and he said he wasn't sure that the FedEx would get there in time. But why didn't I just go into a French pharmacy and ask for it? I said, well, it's a prescription. He said, well, in France, things are different. So I went in, and sure enough, this woman just opened a drawer, took out a little capsule for me, and charged me an amount that my local pharmacy said is something like one-fifth of what he pays for it wholesale. How do we wind up in a situation like that?
Well, we wound up in it in large measure because of the laws that we've written. We have allowed the laws to be so lopsidedly in favor of the pharmaceuticals and in opposition to pharmaceutical customers that we ought to be ashamed at the current set of circumstances.
But the Democrats ran Congress for many years. We had Republican presidents, we had Democratic presidents, but Congress was pretty much solidly Democratic for, I don't know, 20 years or so.
Well, not while I served. I was Democratic leader for 10 years, and I only had the opportunity to be majority leader for about two of those 10. So I'd like to think that we were in the majority longer, but that's not the case, actually. We had Republican Congress, Republican presidents. Bill Clinton worked largely with a Republican president for six of the 8 years that he served. But nonetheless, it doesn't matter. Finger-pointing doesn't help. It's what we've got to do now is fix the problem. And I think that the way we fix the problem is once again to bring the pressure that we can bring if we pool our resources to negotiate with the drug prices and to give the government the ability to negotiate with drug pricing as well. That's what we have. The big difference. You ask, what's the difference between France and the United States? France negotiates with drug price companies on price. We don't do that. We actually have a law that prohibits the American government from negotiating drug prices with pharmaceuticals today.
Why are you supporting Senator Obama when you have had such a long-standing relationship with the Clintons?
Well, for a lot of reasons, I guess, in part because I think he'd make a better president, because in part I think he can bring this country together, because I think he's got remarkable leadership, can not only bring us together, but bring a lot of people who've never really been involved in politics into the political process for the first time. When I attend one of his events and I see 20,000 people, most of whom have never attended a political event before, it makes that point. I believe he has that capacity.
Well, there was a sense of momentum, and then there was a setback on past Tuesday's primaries. So is the message getting lost?
I don't think at all. I mean, he came from about 20 to 25 points down in both Ohio and Texas to a point where at one point we actually thought we were close to winning. We knew we had a huge deficit to make up, and I believe that had we had a little more time, we probably would have made it up, but we didn't quite make it. But we did close the gap. When you come down to delegates, Hillary won 158 delegates on Tuesday. Barack won 153 delegates on Tuesday. So the break in delegates was very, very close, and that reflected, I think, the vote in all four states.
Are you a superdelegate?
Yes, I am.
I know who you're voting for, but do you think the Democrats will take the race all the way to the convention?
I don't believe so. I think it will be resolved prior to that.
We have Florida and Michigan, but Hillary really has both of those states, doesn't she?
Well, she doesn't. She's claiming that she has votes in Michigan, but both of those states are states where none of the presidential candidates competed. So to claim victory when there was an understanding among all the candidates that there wouldn't be any particular activity on the part of the candidates seems to me to be not in keeping with the commitment that all candidates made.
The pundits are saying that the longer this fight between Hillary and Barack continues, the more it helps John McCain.
Well, I don't know. I think it's conventional wisdom is usually wrong, and I think that would be conventional wisdom. I would say, though, that it has energized the parties in all these states where we've seen activity. We've had 43 contests now. Barack has won 28 of those 43, and in Pennsylvania, we're going to see tremendous activity. We're going to see people come out being touched by the candidates. We're going to see greater debate. I don't know what John McCain does over these next 2 months to get visibility, but there's going to be a lot of visibility on the Democratic side.
Tom Daschle is a former U.S. Senator and Senate Majority Leader from South Dakota. He is currently Special Policy Advisor at the law firm Alston and Byrd, LLP. He's a visiting professor at the Georgetown Public Policy Institute and a distinguished senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. And he has written, with the help of Scott S. Greenberger and Gene M. Lambrew, a book called Critical: What We Can Do About the Healthcare Crisis. It is published by St. Martin's Press in the Thomas Dunn Books imprint. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.